We're rocking. Make me feel like a DJ. I used to be one of those, actually. It is 10 minutes after 11 o'clock. This is WGN Radio. Thank you, Andrea. She's the best. And I am Steve Dale on WGN Radio. I'm filling in. I'm honored to fill in. Part of this you can see on Facebook Live, actually, in just a moment as well. And my guest in studio right now is Paul Vallis, who's running for the mayor for the city of Chicago. Mr. Vallis, also coming up later in the program, in about 30 minutes or so, will be former Governor Pat Quinn. Here's what I need to ask the governor. I need to ask him a question that is rather personal. He may need to pardon me. I don't know if he can still do that or not, but we're going to find out why he needs to pardon me. Also, in addition to that, we'll be talking with an amazing guy. He's really a hero. He makes prosthetics for people all over the world, including Paralympians. Many of them thank this guy. His name is David Rotter. He lives in Chicago. He's a Chicagoan. You know, we have so many Chicagoans who they don't get the publicity. And we do so many good things in this city. We hear about the negative stuff. We sometimes, and that's maybe where I'll start, sometimes don't hear about the positive. And there's positives that happen every single day here. Correct?
Absolutely. You know, look, the Chicago Public Schools over the really past decade have continued. In terms of academic performance, the kids have continued to improve. The test scores have been rising for the better part of a decade and a half, even longer.
So you think our schools get a bad rap?
The graduation rates. I think the point that I'm saying is, despite of all the problems, despite of all the scandals, despite of having 4 superintendents in 7 years, despite having one superintendent or CEO going to prison for corruption. I mean, you know, despite the contracts being given to private contractors to clean the buildings, then getting a 73% failure rate, and then getting the contracts renewed. I mean, despite all those things, the teachers go to work every day. They work hard. They commit themselves to our children, and the children continue to slowly progress. So there's people who go about their business, firefighters, police officers, teachers, public servants every day, working men and women, people, parents caring for their children, doing the right thing, you know, engaged and immersed.
In all neighborhoods.
Yeah, in all neighborhoods, across the city, in all neighborhoods, from the affluent neighborhoods to the poorest neighborhoods. And people go about their business. And in some cases, they continue to thrive. And in some cases, they struggle to survive, but they persevere. And that's the greatness of the city. So certainly, you know, the city gets a lot of national attention, as is well deserved, because we're such a cultural center. And the city is really... it's a city of the arts. It's an industrial city in terms of its creativity, in terms of its economic dynamism. But every single day, heroes in every community go about tending to their communities, helping their communities, raising their families, working hard every day, providing, and just and they're heroes in their own right. So you're absolutely right. This is a city of heroes from all walks of life, from all neighborhoods.
So why are you running for mayor? That doesn't seem like a fun job.
Well, you know, I'm running because I think the city's in trouble, and I think the city's really been.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but you said I think the city is in trouble.
Well, I know.
I believe. Sorry, yeah, right.
I believe the city's in trouble.
Yeah, but that's pretty much a fact.
You know, look, by every indicator, this is a city, in crisis. We have a higher murder rate than Chicago, than New York and L.A. combined. Last year, because of the if you look at what's happened with the police department and the failure to fill critical police positions like the detective ranks, we're allowed to decline from 1,200 to less than 700. So they're clearing shootings at a 4% rate. They're clearing murders at a 17% rate. They're clearing the carjackings at a 9% rate. You look at the problems with the schools. I mean, despite the hardworking teachers.
Well, I want to stop. Hang on a second, because I don't want to just slide by the crime issue. Yeah. It's worth talking about a little bit. So for years, people of all walks of life, including some of the aldermen, most of them were saying, we need more police officers. And finally, before an election, the mayor says, we're going to add more police officers. Is that the only answer? And is that even a part of the answer?
Well, first of all, you have to address the underlying issues for crime. You know, you have the social economic condition. And so, you know, when I...
Are we living in two different cities?
Well, when I announced my public safety initiatives a few months ago, you know, the reaction from City Hall immediately was, well, you need to focus on the conditions that cause crime. Well, I am. I'm talking about housing. I'm talking about economic development. I'm talking about improving schools. So clearly we do have a tale of two cities here. We have communities here that have not yet recovered from the 2008 recession. And indeed, some communities on the west side haven't recovered from the 1968 riots. I grew up in the Roseland community. I went to three public public schools in Roseland, Pullman, Curtis, Fenger. When you go to Roseland, when you walk the other Michigan Avenue, 113th Street, you know what I mean? The abandoned Gately People Store that has been vacant for, what, three decades? I mean, you see communities where they don't even have fast food places, let alone restaurants and retail, et cetera. I mean, you have areas of the city that are not only mired in recessions, but indeed they're mired in depression. So it is a tale of two cities. When you go to the south side of the city of Chicago and you have 30, 40, 50% of the men in some phase of the criminal justice system, and without the adult ed and occupational training skills to find gainful employment, and without the support system there to get them back on track, we have the tale of two cities. You know, the property values in this city since the last recession have declined by 17%. People don't realize this. Where nationally they've grown by 7.5%. So when you have declining population, and this city, I think, for the last 5 years has lost population.
Yep.
We're like, we're one of the, I believe we're close to the top in terms of a large city in terms of population loss, continuous population loss. But when you're losing population and you're losing value, property value, it means that the city in many ways is a city in decline. And when you consider, you look at the downtown area, you look at the near north side, you look at that 3, 4, 5 mile radius outside the loop, and all you see is, you see the cranes, the high rises, everything's going up. How can the city be losing value when you see all this construction? What that means is you've got areas of the city that haven't lost 15, 16, 70% property values. They've lost 25, 30, 40% property values. And you see it in the abandoned homes. You see it in the homes that are in foreclosure. You see it in the bankruptcies. I mean, you see it in the vacant storefronts. You see what I mean? So indeed, we are becoming a tale of two cities. And for too many families, too many working families, not just the poor, but the working families, the middle class families, the city is becoming less and less affordable.
Yeah.
And we see it not only with our rising property tax. People don't realize property taxes have gone up. Taxes, fees, and fines have gone up over almost $2 billion in the last 7 years since this mayor took office.
Where's all that money going?
Well, part of it is going to, shore up the funding for the pension system. But look at this. I saw a statistic the other day that the cities, and it's interesting. If you go and you look at the budget, if you look at the budget online, you see one number. If you Google city employment statistics, you get another number. There's like three or four numbers out there. But what's clear is the number of city positions, the number of city employees has declined. The number has declined by, depending on what statistic you're looking at, anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000. Yet, the city budget has continued to climb, separate from pension funding, and how can be happening if you have fewer and fewer positions? It's because they're paying hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in overtime. You know, is this any way to manage the city? We don't have enough police officers on the street because they reneged on their promise to hire 1,000 police officers. I think they eventually eliminated close to 2,000 positions in the budget. And now, of course, they're rushing to fill those positions. They have two shifts at the police academy. You know?
So today was probably an example of that. We had, I guess I called it a parade earlier when I was talking to Patty and Andrea, but it was the protest, the peace march that went up Lakeshore Drive, closed Lakeshore Drive. Maybe 200 people. I don't know. I'm not good at those numbers. Right. But I saw it because I was out jogging in my neighborhood when they come up to Wrigley Field. So I saw it all. What would you have done, if anything, different? And by the way, this is probably a case of there were more police there, which is good. I felt safe. People at Wrigley Field probably felt safe. So I'm glad the police were there. Well, but there were more police than marchers.
Well, let me answer the question. You know, let me make my point about the decline in the number of police. And let me just say, I think they handled the situation well. I think they handled the situation well today. I mean, they had more police because they didn't know how many people were going to come. They wanted to control the crowd. I give a lot of credit to the individuals who were organizing, Teal Hardeman and Dr. Livingston, whatever. So, I mean, you know, they conducted their protests in a constructive way. And I think the city handled it appropriately and effectively. But the point that I was trying to make is that what they're doing is, because of the severe police shortages, you've got police working overtime. You've got the police working for 13, 14 straight days. You've got them moving police officers from one community to another to deal with hotspots. Or in the case of the escalating crime on Michigan Avenue and on Lakeshore Drive, suddenly you're flooding those areas with police officers that you're pulling from the communities. You know, sitting around, the police themselves refer to their activities as scarecrow patrols because they're just sitting there mm-hmm. establishing a presence. Is that any way to run a police force? You know, so there are a lot of issues that have surfaced concerning the police. You know, not only the challenges in dealing with the rising tide of crime, but also the issues of police accountability. But when you don't have enough police officers, and I'm talking about when you're short 1,500 police officers, when you allow your detectives division to attrit down by 40%. So instead of having 1,200 detectives, you have fewer than 700 detectives. When you haven't filled your sergeant positions, so you have 30 officers being supervised by a sergeant as opposed to 10 officers being supervised by a sergeant. When you wait 5 to 6 years to start buying them tasers and training them on how to use tasers, when you don't have the type of comprehensive and continuous redundant professional development, so you're teaching the police officers on how to effectively deal with de-escalation issues or deal with individuals who they encounter with mental health issues, because the mayor closed 12 mental health centers to save a measly $2.5 million. Yeah. When you do those things, guess what you get? Guess what you produce? The result is you're losing the battle when it comes to getting a handle on crime, and you have accountability issues. You see, at the end of the day, there's no substitute to providing the police with the resources they need, the infrastructure they need, the supervision they need, the training, the continuous training, and the redundant training that they need, and the equipment that they need to be effective. Because you can strengthen your police department and simultaneously make that department more accountable. And I just think that they've created conditions. They've created the conditions which are resulting in many of the problems that the police department is facing today. Well, and as mayor, I'm going to change that.
I believe you will. If I'll need the police out here, though, if I don't, I'll need the commercial police if I don't read
okay,
this.
Okay.
Chicago is hosting the ultimate month-long food festival this August. Visit ctfoodbowl.com to get your seat at the table.
Minnesota scored the go-ahead run.
Tomorrow night.
Got him swinging. Sox win. Sox win.
The Sox travel to Florida to take on the Tampa Bay Rays.
WGN Nightside, I'm Steve Dale, and my guest is mayoral candidate Paul Vallis. Our phone number, 312-981-7200. You can text us at that same number. Okay, we have just about a minute and a half before news.
One of your callers...
Texter, yeah.
Basically said, identify the problems and the solutions. I think I pretty much clear... I think I was pretty specific mm-hmm. about what the problems are, the significant neglect in providing the police department with the resources, the staffing, the training that they need. What would I do to solve it? I actually presented a comprehensive plan in April, and what I would do is I would increase police strength to 14,200. That would ensure that there would be enough police officers in every community so that you would have beat integrity. In other words, you wouldn't be have to move police officers around. The second thing that we would do is we would make sure that you had the type of supervisory infrastructure in place, one sergeant for every 30, for every 10 officers, the appropriate number of training officers. Third is you would have constant redundant training in the critical areas, including de-escalation, et cetera. And you would make sure that your police officers had the equipment that they need and were trained in the equipment, from tasers to the cameras, et cetera. Now the question is, well, how are you going to pay for that? And let me point out, my goal would also be to have a police officer in every school and to double the number of police officers on the CTA stations. What happens is, if you have police officers in every school, is when schools are out, then you have another 600 officers that you can deploy to the parks or downtown or to recreational areas where the kids are at without pulling police officers from neighborhoods. You understand what I'm saying? And the question is how you could pay for that. Well, first of all, the mere fact that you would now not have to pay $150, $175 million in overtime, because the amount of money paid in overtime has ranged from like $75 million to like $185 million, that in itself would come a long way towards providing the additional funding needed to, in effect, provide the police officers with the type of resources and support that they would need to be effective and to ensure that there were greater accountability. Because there's no more effective accountability than training, and supervision. So that's how I'd solve the problem. And you can go to my website. And on my website, I lay out in detail
all of that.
Okay.
Yes or no, because I've got a break for news here. Fan of neighborhood policing as well as a part of the solution?
Yeah, the answer is yes, but you can't have effective community policing unless you have beat integrity, which means you have officers in the community who are always going to be in that community.
And know the community.
And they know the community, and the community knows them. See?
Yep.
That's critical.
Yep, I agree with that, and that's what the experts say, actually. It is 11:31 on WGN. Steve Dale here with Paul Vallis. We'll continue and take your phone calls if you like, 312-981-7200. Take text questions as well. Hello there. Steve Dale back with you. Steve Dale on WGN Radio with Paul Vallis, who is running for mayor for the city of Chicago. For further information, people have texted, what is the website to learn more? Because you said, go to the website and you can learn more and learn more details. It's Vallis, V-A-L-L-A-S, VallisForAllChicago.com. So there I am driving along any of the Chicago streets. The light is yellow. It turns red. I see that flashing light, the red light cameras, those darn red light cameras. Are they really there for safety?
No, they were never really intended to be there for safety.
Really?
The Tribune, I believe, did a whole series on the red light cameras. First of all, the scandals in the bidding process. And then they did a study of the cameras and really pointed out that, or really strongly suggested that they were there for revenue collection, not safety. Let me tell you, the fee and fine structure in this city is cruel and unusual punishment. Look.
I think most Chicagoans may relate to that.
When I become mayor, my plan is to phase out the red light cameras. I don't have a problem with speed cameras in certain selected areas, particularly school zones and things like that. But when it comes to the red light camera program was intended to tax people, and unfortunately, that tax falls heavily on working families and the poor. pure and simple. But the whole fee and fine structure in the city is outrageous. I mean, look at the study that was done in recently on the vehicle stickers. Mm. I mean, do you realize that you can get ticketed every day for the failure to pay your vehicle sticker? You know, I had this Uber driver who couldn't pay her vehicle sticker, so she got ticketed so many times that the price of a vehicle sticker eventually became a $1,000 plus debt that she is now paying through a payment plan to the city. There have been 10,000 bankruptcies caused by fees and fines owed. People have not been able to pay. 10,000 people have filed for bankruptcy because of their inability to pay. In 2016, the last year that we have comprehensive data, 21,000 licenses. The city requested that the state suspend 21,000 licenses of individuals because they were scofflaws. Now, I mean, what are we trying to do here? I mean, people can't go to work. If they can't go to work, they can't earn money. If they can't earn money, they can't provide for their families. If they can't earn money, they can't pay their fees and fines. So I just think it's reached the point where it's overkill. And whether it's raising property taxes, probably one of the most regressive taxes out there, or sales taxes or whatever, or for that matter, imposing fees and fines, which seem to disproportionately all the studies that have been out there that I've read and the studies that have been well publicized in the newspapers point out the degree to which these fees and fines is falling disproportionately on the poor and specifically on the minority community.
So there's no question about that. But then the city needs money, so where does the city get revenue from? Or is this money we really don't need?
Well, you know, one of the things, right now, we've reached the point where I believe about 7.5% of our budget is dependent, our operating budget is dependent on fees and fines. So we're rapidly approaching the point of no return. And I think what we've got to do with our entire revenue structure is look at how we raise money, number one. We need to look at how we raise money and how we can structure our revenue generating initiatives, whether they're taxes, fees, and fines, so that they're more tied to people's ability to pay. You know, so I think we have to review our entire tax structure, and then at the same time, we've got to look at what we're doing on the expenditure side. Now, clearly, the courts have pretty much said you don't have a lot of flexibility when it comes to fully funding your pension system, because the courts have basically ruled that you can't really change commitments that you made, pension commitments that you made to employees. So you have to address it as a revenue issue. Clearly, we still have that issue to address. But I've got to believe in a city that builds a Wintrust arena for $175 million. You know, we need another stadium like we need a hole in the head. Just
explain what it is that you're talking about for
people. Well, the Wintrust arena was an arena built by McCormick Place. And basically, they actually took they transferred something like $50 million in TIF money to that arena.
We have to explain TIF money.
And TIF money is tax increment financing money. Basically, what they do is when they create a TIF, the TIF program was designed to serve as a redevelopment vehicle. And then essentially what they do when they create a TIF is they, in effect, take the revenue growth, theoretically, that comes from the development, and they set that revenue growth aside, and they use that money to subsidize investments in that redevelopment, whether it's providing loans or making infrastructure improvements and things like that. But do you know that they divert? David Orr just put out a report. In the county as a whole, over $1 billion in property tax money is diverted to TIFs. In the city, it's something like, is it $650 million, $660 million? An exorbitant amount of money is actually shifted to TIFs. And what's happening is a lot of times this TIF money is not being used in blighted areas. Sometimes it's being used for economic development or to provide incentives or infrastructure improvements in more affluent areas. The point to be made here is we've taken, and
Wasn't the idea of these TIF funds to help redevelopment in communities that really, truly need it?
Yeah, but what's happened over the years is, number one, TIF proceeds have been used, you know, not necessarily in the most blighted areas. And very often, TIFs have been created in areas that were not necessarily blighted. So there clearly has been an abuse. But let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to do something unprecedented as a candidate. I'm actually going to develop my own long-term financial plan. And in about 2 weeks, I'm going to present it. And I'm going to talk about what I'm going to do to address the pension funding issue, what I'm going to do to make the revenue generating system here, that means the taxes and fees and fines, more progressive, how I'm going to finance the phase out of the red light cameras, you know, and how I'm going to be able to finance the modifications in these punitive penalties that are like the penalties that loan sharks would stick you with for not paying your loans. When you consider that, like with a vehicle sticker, you can get ticketed every day, and a simple failure to purchase a single vehicle sticker can eventually result in you owing the city $1,000. So I'm going to lay out my financial plan in all detail, and I'm going to certainly challenge the other candidates to do likewise. Because people, you know, the mayor just introduced his preliminary budget and basically said, city's in the best shape since 2008, 2009. Yeah. But he doesn't tell you how he's going to finance the $1.1 billion in additional pension funding that's going to be needed. That's annually.
Yeah.
Over the next 4 to 5 years, it's going to build up to that. He doesn't tell you how he's going to pay for the collective bargaining agreements, the firefighters, the police contracts that are going to be retroactive. You know, there are so many things that he doesn't tell you about. You know, he's already promised $2 billion in infrastructure upgrades, doesn't tell you how he's going to pay for it, so that he makes all the CTA stations ADA accessible.
It's about time.
It's about time. But where's he going to get the $2 billion? He's going to do universal early childhood education for four-year-olds after the election. But don't worry, the state's going to pay for it. He suddenly has $1 billion he's proposing $1 billion in school construction, but he hasn't identified what taxes he's going to raise order to pay for that. My point is, what we need to do is we need... we don't need smoking mirrors. We don't need one-year budgets. We need to know from all the candidates what their long-term financial vision is going to be for the city. And I'm going to present mine, and I'm going to challenge, obviously, the mayor and others to present theirs.
All right. In 30 seconds, and I do mean 30 seconds,
all right.
Why should we vote for you for mayor? There are a lot of candidates. Why you?
Well, first of all, I've been managing multi-billion dollar budgets for 15 of my 17 years, when I was in an administrative capacity, CEO, budget director for the city in 3 years, when we not only had enough cops and resurfaced 70% of the streets, but we didn't raise property taxes, CEO of the Chicago Public Schools. I took over the Chicago Public Schools in 1995. They had a projected $1.2 billion structural deficit. When I left the school 6 years later, we had cash balances and all of our funds of close to $1 billion, and our credit rating was upgraded 13 times. That's both the city and the schools during my tenure. I mean, you know, despite the most recent increase in the city's credit rating, they're still at junk bond status. So the point is, I've been dealing with large government institutions in crisis situations for decades, and I've been going in and I've been straightening out the problems, and I've been setting those institutions, those school districts, on the right track. And it's resulted in an equitable distribution of resources, and it's resulted in academic and programmatic improvement. So I think I have the requisite skills in terms of developing long-term financial plans, managing budgets, holding the line on taxes, and at the same time improving the delivery of services.
Okay, you're going to be back Sunday morning on my Sunday morning show. We're going to talk about way early at 6:35. You're going to make an announcement regarding your concerns about animal welfare.
Absolutely.
And why that's very important for the city. Paul Vallis, thank you very much. It's VallisForAllChicago.com. Paul, again, thank you. The governor, former governor Pat Quinn, your pal, he'll be here in just a moment, so don't move. Yes, that sounds official, doesn't it? You know, I didn't know what that song was until today, but this man may, in fact, know what that tune is all about. He is former Governor Pat Quinn. Good evening, Governor Quinn.
Well, how you doing there, Steve? It's always good to talk to you anytime, day or night.
Well, it's good to talk to you as well. Did you recognize that tune?
Not exactly. It didn't sound like John Philip Sousa, but
it's supposed to be
pretty good.
That's supposed to be the Illinois State theme song. So when the President of the United States comes out, they play that song, and this is supposed to be the same sort of thing for the state of Illinois, but I guess you can't always believe the internet. I don't know. We looked it up. We tried. I have a question to ask you before we launch into what I know you want to talk about. First of all, I congratulate you, Governor. This is Governor Pat Quinn, I believe the only Illinois governor in my lifetime never to serve time in jail. So that's a very good thing. You must hear that a lot, actually. But
there's a couple of governors, Governor Thompson and Governor Jim Edgar there.
Yes.
May have avoided any kind of incarceration. It's unfortunate you even have to say it, although when I was governor for 6 years. At one time, there were two former governors, Blagojevich and Ryan, George Ryan, both in jail at the same time. So we had work to do, passing ethics laws and straightening things out, and we got the job done.
So quickly, because I know we have limited time here, but I need to ask you this question. Can you still pardon people?
Not anymore.
I acted on
almost 5,000 clemencies when I was governor, but once you leave, that's the end of that. Indeed, on the last day, my last day before noon on the, I guess it was 10th or 12th of January of 2015, I did act on a number of clemencies that were, people, frankly, who were wrongly convicted, and you got to straighten that out. That's what justice is all about.
Well, here's why I ask. I was just in London. I was invited to a meeting of cat experts, and it was at the House of Lords. Pretty fancy, huh? I mean, that's like the U.S. It's like the Congress. So I thought, oh my gosh, I'm at this amazing, historic. I mean, the place is, it makes our Congress building look new. I mean, it's a thousand years old or something, you know, and this giant, historic, wonderful building. So I will tell you, just between us, I stole a fork. I walked up because it has the insignia on it of the House of Lords. I know. So do I need pardoning?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm afraid I don't have that authority, but I know I was in the White House when I was governor on a number of occasions, and they have, like, napkins, which they encourage you to take. I did not take any forks or any silverware, but, you know, the napkins have the White House, and anything that's kind of a souvenir like that is good. But next time you go back to London, you better bring the fork.
So tell me about a petition that I know you're encouraging people to sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's term limits on the mayor of Chicago. It's a referendum, Steve, under the Constitution of Illinois. If we get 52,519 signatures by Monday, that's the deadline, then on the ballot in November, when people go to vote for governor and all the other offices, they'll get a chance to vote for a binding referendum on whether the mayor of Chicago should be limited to two terms. This is, frankly, what the rule is in every other big city across America. New York has a two-term limit, and so does Los Angeles and Houston, Philadelphia. Of the 10 biggest cities in our country, only Chicago has no limit whatsoever on how long the mayor can serve, and we at least want to give voters a chance to vote on that in November. And anybody listening, like to learn more about it, our website is takechargechicago.org. You can download a petition if you want to help, because we've gathered literally thousands of names that will file on Monday afternoon down at City Hall, but we're still gathering signatures all weekend long, and it's a very important issue that people should at least have a chance to vote on.
Absolutely, but now I hear that the mayor's office wants to put these other, because there only could be so many referendums apparently on the ballot at the same time, and wants to put these other referendums on the ballot, like the day begins on Monday, the first day of the week, or that 12 o'clock can be called 12 noon. I mean, ridiculous things on the ballot just to fill up the space.
Yeah, that's kind of sad. It's underhanded, obviously. The mayor is terrified. Mayor Rahm Emanuel is terrified this referendum, to have a two-term limit on him, will be put on the ballot by the voters through petition. But they've done it in 25 cities across Illinois, including Naperville and Springfield and Downers Grove and Oak Lawn and on and on. And we want to do it in Chicago, and the mayor can't take away our right. It's a constitutional right. And, you know, we had an advisory referendum on whether or not we should ban plastic straws. That's all well and good, but he's not going to get away with keeping a binding referendum, putting a term limit on the mayor. That is something the voters are entitled to vote on, and when we file our petitions on Monday afternoon, we are going to fight to make sure that the Constitution is upheld and the people have a chance to vote.
And one more time, what is that website?
Yeah, the website's takechargechicago.org, and you can download a petition if you want, or anybody listening wanted to call us. We're at 773, and our phone number is, that's the area code, and it's 999-2016. And, you know, it's interesting. Yesterday we had a 91-year-old man come in, George Otto, with 300 signatures.
Wow.
That he had gotten. And this afternoon I was with a young fellow, just got out of college, 21 years old, and he had 300 and plus signatures. So, you know, it's something that we need to do more of, really, in Chicago and Illinois. Let voters have a chance to vote on referendum issues as well as candidates. And term limits on the mayor, we already have term limits on the president of, you know, 8 years, two terms. And
yep.
If it's good enough for Barack, it ought to be good enough for Rahm Emanuel.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate you staying up late for us. Thank you, former Governor Pat Quinn. It's, you know, I'm a pal, and it's always good to talk to you.
Well, you're our hero. Anybody who loves dogs, cats, or animals, Steve, you're the North Star that leads us. And I want to say, when I was governor, I depended on you over and over again to make sure that we did things right.
Well, I'm grateful for that. There goes Governor Pat Quinn. If he sounds like a good guy, it's because he is.
Come on, every time you whack it, something else falls off. Let's walk. Yeah, I guess you're right. She's dead. She's got a rusted, beat-up, busted gut, the dirty, miserable son of a stuffed bear cat. Got a fouled-up battery, a comped-out fuel pump, the carburetor's belching, the whole darn thing ain't worth a spit.
That was Lucille Ball and Paula Stewart. Hi, Paula!
Hi, Steve. Oh, that was fun. I didn't expect that. That was a nice little, you know, that was a lovely little memory.
Well, you know, I knew Lucille Ball a bit. We've been emailing back and forth. And Wanda Clark, her secretary, who I have been still in touch with, said that she would call me the nice boy from Chicago or something to that effect. And uh-huh. I interviewed her a lot, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10 times. And when she came to Chicago, I would talk to her as well. But you,
That's great.
Pardon me?
That's great.
Well, you, though, her bestie. I mean, you were the best pals. And you met one another, and the name of the book, and you've written a book about it, Lucy Loved Me, the perfect book title, because, of course, the show was I Love Lucy, but you called it the book, Lucy Loved Me. And you met one another. We just heard a clip from an appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show when Wildcat was on Broadway and you were recreating a scene from Wildcat. And that's how you met, correct?
No, that's not true.
Oh, how did you meet? You did not meet?
I auditioned for the... if you read the book, you'll find out that I auditioned for... for Michael Kidd before I ever even knew who Lucy was, because I was always working in the theater at night, and when she was on doing her show, I Love Lucy, that was at night when I was at the theater. So I really didn't know too much about Lucille Ball, and when I was asked to audition for it, I went and auditioned, you know, for Michael Kidd, and who was the director, and he said, "Oh, Paul, you're great." Of course, I knew I was, but but he says, "You're too much like Lucy." I didn't know what that meant. So when Lucy was very frustrated because they still hadn't cast the part for her sister, and she had heard about me, and she asked Michael Kidd, "What about this girl, Paula Stewart?" And Michael Kidd said, "Well, oh, Lucy, she's too much like you." And Lucy said, "What? She's supposed to be my sister. She's too much like me. I want to see her tomorrow." So that's how I met her. I went for another audition, and when I sang for her, actually, she was in the back of the theater, so all she did was say, "Yep, that's it." And I thought it was Get the Hook, but, you know, it was her saying that she wanted me to play the part. But I didn't really meet her in person until the first run-through with the cast and, the musicians and the dancers. And that's where I met her. And it was because I went up to her and asked her if she would like me to help her with her songs. And she just thought that was a really, really nice thing for me to do. And we bonded from that moment on.
Well, that's kind of right. So that must have been kind of or maybe not, an intimidating sort of thing to do. So Lucy was having...
Not
Lucy,
at all. Lucy, I didn't know who she was, and I wasn't intimidated, but I knew a lot of stars at that point because, you know, I was already a star on Broadway myself, and I wasn't intimidated by this woman. I just thought I could maybe help her because she certainly didn't know how to sing. Lucy was never known for her singing voice, you know. And when she opened her mouth, the whole cast and the crew and everything said, "Uh-oh, this show's never going to make it."
But you remained friends for a very long time, and you were kind of like sisters in real life as well. And, you know, no matter what happened in your life, Lucy was always there for you, which I want to get to for a second. But your life in of itself, yeah, that's right. You were a star on Broadway. What's more, at one point in time, for example, you were married to a guy by the name of Burt Bacharach.
Right.
Who composed...
And then later I was married to a comedian, Jack Carter.
Well, all right, so I want to talk about that. So if it wasn't for you and your husband, Jack Carter, at the time, would Lucy have met Gary Morton, who became her husband after she divorced Desi? Tell that story.
That's right. No, I was the one who suggested to Jack that I thought that Gary Morton might be an interesting date for her. Now, Lucy didn't want to meet anybody. She was, you know, she was really off men at that point, you know, after the divorce with Desi. She didn't want to meet anybody else. But I persisted, and I thought that they would make an interesting couple as friends. So finally, she agreed to go out with us, to go out after the theater one night, and that's how she met Gary.
And it was
very cute watching them. They were like kids, you know, playing. And it was a really funny scene. If you read it in the book, you'll know what I mean.
Uh-huh. And I don't want to give away that scene, but here's what I do want to ask you. So you were responsible for introducing her to Gary Morton, her husband after Desi Arnaz. It turns out she was married to Gary Morton longer than she was married to Desi Arnaz, right? But throughout the book, you offer examples here and there how Gary, shall we say, watched his pocketbook, and it seemed that he was more concerned about other things at times other than Lucy. Is a part of you think that, my gosh, I wish I had not introduced them? Or, to the best that you can tell, their marriage overall was a good thing. And you
it
know,
was the best thing for her after Desi. And she really, really did, you know, care for him. And he cared for her. And he was very loyal and very faithful to her. And he certainly, you know, was a handsome, good-looking, you know, stud to have around after, you know, the disaster with Desi. So I thought he played golf an awful lot, and he made up for it, you know, by kibitzing with her and joking with her, and he was really a good husband to her.
But toward the end of
it, he was penurious. He was very cheap, but it never with her.
Well, you do tell stories, and one of those stories, I don't want to tell them all, but one of those stories toward the end of Lucy's life, the margarita and the salt story, and Gary and this wonderful nurse that was there for Lucy, he fired at some point. So at times you were kind of critical about this guy in the book.
Well, yes, I was, but that's, you know, I couldn't just, not talk about, you know, everything that I was seeing or understanding at the time. I was being very, fair to the readers, to let them know what was going on. And Gary was, he wasn't my favorite person toward the end, but he was always good to Lucy, so I can't fault him for that.
You know, when I spoke to Lucy, she would say, because I would ask about a certain performer, and she would say, well, I love doing girl talk. That was the expression I remember. So I want to do some girl talk with you, even though I kind of don't fit the bill exactly. And mostly, I want to find out what Lucy was really like. We will do all of that when we come back. Is that okay, Paula?
Of course.
Paula Stewart.
I'd also like to talk about all, your animals that you've had and compare them with all the animals that I've had in my life.
I would love that. All right, there's Paula Stewart. Lucy Loved Me. That's the name of the book, and you're on WGN.
You gotta say, hey, look me over, lend me an ear. Fresh out of clover, mortgage up to here. But don't pass the plate, folks, don't pass the cup. I figure whenever you're down and out, the only way is up and out. I like the road, but high on the vine.
I want to keep playing that song. It's such an upbeat song. We're talking to Paula Stewart, author of Lucy Loved Me, and she was on...
Yes, and Lucy finally learned how to sing that song, thanks to me.
Well, she did.
I was so proud of her because she really sounded pretty good on that, right?
Yeah, I think so. And you know what? I think... So Lucy Ricardo, that character, the whole thing was she couldn't sing. Lucy personally, I would tell me... that people like, Carol Burnett, I love her. She's so talented. She can sing and dance. And I'd say, well, you do that. And she'd say, no, I don't do that. But she did do that, I think.
That's true.
And then she would say, okay, maybe I could, but it took me extra work. You know, it didn't come naturally to me. So she wasn't the greatest singer maybe on the planet ever in the history, but she could, and you're the one who helped coach her for that, as you explain in the book Lucy Loved Me. What was Lucille Ball like? That's the bottom line question, I suppose.
Well, Lucy and I were very similar. We had very similar tastes. We loved clothes. We loved fashion. She loved, absolutely adored, clothes and purses. We used to go out shopping for purses in New York. And, I still have some of them left. And it's really amazing that we had so much in common. Eventually, she liked my decorating. And she had me decorate her houses. And this is after I decorated her life with Gary.
Yes.
But anyway, we both loved animals. At one point, I used to breed Yorkshire Terriers, and at one time, you'll read it in the book, she came over and helped me whelp a couple of puppies, which was really marvelous of her, because Lucy was a really regular person. She was not crazy, kooky. She was a very elegant person, and she had, she had great, great style.
Loyal. So loyal that she had one dog named Tinker, and then had another dog. When that dog passed away,
that was named Tinker too.
Uh huh.
And every one of her poodles was named Tinkerbell.
Yeah, because also
and they were all little tiny little nasty little dogs.
Also, she'd walk around with those dogs, but also
she'd walk around with them. They only liked Lucy, and they were so tiny. They were miniature poodles, little white poodles, and they were really very, very pretty. But they didn't like anybody else but Lucy.
Lucy
was very loyal to her.
She didn't like,
and she treated them like her babies.
Yeah.
You know, she would have like a crib like in the bedroom, you know, and that's where the you know, Tinkerbell would sleep
in a crib in the bedroom. But you know,
yes.
She did not like change. So when you decorated for her, how did she take to that?
Oh, she loved anything I did. She went along with everything I did. She didn't have any great taste in decorating. And, that was the one thing. She was great with clothes and purses and shoes and makeup and hair and all that. But the decorating, you know, furnishings, that was not her forte. So she left that up to me. And I did most of, you know, I picked out most of the furniture and the colors and the color schemes. And she listened to anything I wanted. Gary was so happy when she finally decided to you know, get rid of the worn carpet in the living room. It looked like, you know, anyway.
So how did she do what I'm about to ask? Here she is on a, for most of the time you knew her, on a regular television series and also doing specials and some years maybe doing a movie. Very, very busy person. But yet it seemed, and you made this clear in the book, whenever you needed her for whatever purpose, and that's what friends are for, you know, whenever you called, she was there.
Yes, well, I was not the only one that she helped out. She was a very, very generous, kind person to her friends, and she helped a lot of young ladies, and I was one of them. And I lived in her guest house for a couple of years after I went bankrupt. Unfortunately, my third husband was a little bit of a con artist, and after I had made millions in real estate, turned me into a bankrupt person. And then I went and lived with her, and she was my savior. That's when she got me into decorating, and she decided, you know, that she was going to go to New York to do Stone Pillow, and that I had to go with her. You know, I had to go, everything, all my furniture and everything had to be moved there. I had to be in the same building as she was. You know, she was amazing. She was just an amazing friend.
All right, and when you refer to Stone Pillow, you're referring to a made-for-TV movie which she played a street person.
And she played it, you know, and it was supposed to be in the winter, and it was done during one of the hottest springs that they ever had in New York, and she was constantly in these heavy, heavy clothes, and I think that added to her eventual demise, because it really was very hard on her. She never should have done that movie.
And she actually said something like that to me at one point. She said exactly what you just said, that that she was playing with all this heavy stuff on, and she suffered dehydration, and she said,
"That's
right. Were you ever dehydrated?" I said, "No." She said, "Oh, it's the most terrible," and she went on about it, you know, and it must have been pretty awful, you know?
Oh, yes. It was, you know, I just felt so badly for her because I was there on the set all the time. She insisted that I stay around, and I would see her sweating under all this clothes. Oh, my God, I felt so sorry for her. But she, you know, Lucy was a trooper. She would, you know, just gung-ho and go straight, you know, do what she had to do. But she was amazing.
She was. So as a comedian, what was her greatest talent, do you think? I'm not sure I'm asking that quite right. I mean, she was clearly, I think, the funniest comedian ever.
She was a clown, and she didn't mind doing outrageous things in order to get a laugh. And listen, a lot of us are like that. Maybe we'll do something, you know, that we wouldn't normally do just to get a laugh. And mm-hmm. when we get a laugh, we're encouraged, you know, to do more things like that. Well, Lucy had this ability to be really wacky and to throw herself into it. And that was lovable about her, that she was willing to, you know, to make herself, you know, unattractive or just to be funny or just to get a laugh.
What did you learn more than anything else from her? I mean, clearly, Lucille Ball, older than you, when you became very, very, very good friends.
Yeah, we were 15 years difference in our ages.
Yeah. So what did you learn more than anything? I'm not talking about as a performer necessarily. Maybe that's it. But whatever the answer is.
Just her, her insight and her generosity and her friendship, and she was just, she was always there for me. She was very honest, and we had a lot of laughs because we had such a similar sense of humor, and it was just, I miss her today. You know, she was one of the dearest person, and she's the closest person, closer than my mother even. And she was just always there for me. She's very, very special.
Would she be surprised that the reruns are still being shown and shown, and yet another generation has grown up watching I Love Lucy?
Isn't that amazing? Yes, I think she'd be very happy about it. But it's amazing. I think it's wonderful that the younger generations will be able to enjoy her like we did.
Well, I think it's wonderful you wrote the book, and I thought the book is absolutely terrific. So if you're a fan of Lucy, Lucy Loved Me, that's the name of the book, Paula Stewart.
Yes, and it's put out by Amazon. You can get it on Amazon.
You can get anything on Amazon, of course.
That's right.
Paula, thank you so much.
Anyway, I we didn't get to talking about our favorite topic, which is animals.
You know what?
It's a future date.
Yeah, we will. And I'll either do it on my pet show on Sunday mornings, or more likely, I'll probably do it in a separate podcast that I do here at WGN. Thank you, Paula.
All right, honey. Really nice talking to you.
The same here. She sounds so nice, doesn't she? Paula Stewart, look her up. You'll recognize her. She's one of those faces. You may not know the name, but you've seen her face if you've watched television shows from the 1960s and 1970s. A prosthesis. Did I say that right? We're going to find out. David Rotter is here. And when I met this guy, I said, you do what? He helps people all over the world who need prosthetic limbs. And in Chicago as well. And Paralympians are, he's responsible for them being in the Olympics. Quite an amazing story to tell. We will talk to him next, right here on WGN. I'm learning things on this show. WGN late night, nightside, late at night, very late at night. I've still got that, I don't have that quite down, do I? I don't think so. What is it, Tom? He'll be able to.
It's WGN nightside.
That's what I said.
Yes. You're doing okay.
Yeah, WGN nightside. That's what I knew. I was close. Kind of like late night, kind of like that way I could feel like David Letterman. Thank you very much for your kind text. Our phone number and text is 312-981-7200. We have so many people, and we were talking, in fact, David Rotter, with a mayoral candidate, Paul Vallis, about this very topic. When bad things happen, it certainly makes the news. But there are great people in Chicago doing amazing things every day that never make the news. You, my friend, are one of those great people for what you do. Now, but I need help here. Prosthetist? I didn't get that right, did I?
No, but nobody gets it right. Ready?
Yeah,
we're ready. Let's all practice together. Prosthetist.
Prosthetist. Now, that doesn't mean you're working on the streets. That would be somebody else.
It depends. that could be someone else. But yeah,
prosthetist.
If you say that 10 times in a row, you're working on the street. So
prosthetist. All right. So that we can say on the radio.
We can.
What is it that you do?
So a prosthetist is a specialist that makes artificial limbs, prosthetics.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the term comes from.
So as a kid, did you say this is something I want to do?
I had no idea as a kid what a prosthetist was. As a kid, I loved to tinker. I loved to build. I probably played with Lego more than any adult should ever admit. And I just, that and helping people, and I found the perfect outlet in prosthetics.
Yeah, how did that come about?
So it was kind of
does one go to school for that?
Yes, actually right over here in Chicago at Northwestern. So I grew up in New York City and came to Northwestern to study prosthetics. Fell in love with the city of Chicago and stayed.
But you also fell in love with the profession.
I did.
And even wanting to be in that profession. How did that come about? Did you want to be a doctor at first?
So, you know, when I was in college, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So for all of you college students out there that are getting nervous that you're not 100% sure that you know what you want to do, it's really okay. I mean, I think hopefully all of us have that moment in life where we say, oh, wow, this is what really moves me.
How did that happen for you?
Yeah, so after I finished college, I was like, well, what do I really want to do? So that book, What Color Is Your Parachute? I had that moment in my life. And what I knew was is that I love to create and build. And I also knew that I love to help people. So I was contemplating medical school, and I was contemplating fields that have design in them, architecture, engineering, industrial design. And just by a coincidence, an occupational therapist that I was speaking with said, oh, my goodness, you should look into prosthetics. I had no idea what it was. I said, well, you know, what is that? So it's a specialist that makes artificial limbs.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like, you know, it would be a combination of interest for you. And that's exactly what it turned out to be.
Now, a silly, stupid question, but, I mean, how are they made, the artificial limbs? How are they constructed? So you have someone that comes to you, and you meet that person. They require that. How is it, I mean, are you involved in the process of actually making it?
Yeah, definitely not a silly, stupid question at all. I mean, that's maybe the most important question. So, yes, that is what a prosthetist does. They're kind of the central figure in constructing that artificial limb, and it's all custom. Every device is custom to the individual. So it's made from a variety of polymer plastics, carbon fiber, certain thermoplastics, along with different materials like aluminum, titanium, and then there's all kinds of different feet. I know it sounds kind of funny, but there's different feet that you can order and make for different people.
So it's not the days of this pirate walking on a peg leg anymore, is it?
No, unless you want to do it for Halloween, no.
So I've seen videos of this. You'll tell me, is this tomorrow's technology or is it here today, where these artificial limbs can do pretty much anything that my arm or your arm can do?
That's tomorrow's technology. So
are we close?
Not what arms can do. No.
How about legs?
We're not close. Legs more so because
really?
We have gravity working in our favor. And
explain what you mean by that.
Sure. So for legs, because we every time we take a step, we're basically counteracting the effects of gravity. We use the physics of our musculoskeletal system to do that. With prosthetic limbs, lower limbs, there are materials that are pretty suitable to the task, and these are gross motor tasks. So the artificial limbs for the lower limb of today are very suited to the task. Now, when you talk about hands, that is a different entity altogether. So a good portion of our brain, our sensory and motor cortex, is just devoted to our fingertips. That's how complex they are as far as nerve endings and just the intricacy of what they're capable of doing. So, you know, all of us that remember Luke Skywalker, that scene in Star Wars where, you know, the machine is putting him back together and all of a sudden he has sensation and... No, we're not quite there yet. We probably have a long way to go, but that's always the focus of a lot of research because I suppose that's the dream, that at some point we can use technology to create that Luke Skywalker vision of a sensate artificial hand.
And what I've seen happen on the veterinary side is like a turtle fin, or even once I think it was done with a dog leg, that, you'll have to explain this to me, because I don't even know what I'm about to say. A copy machine, a 3D copier, can actually create a limb? Is that right?
So,
or are we talking something, a porpoise, actually, as well, a fin? I mean, is this something that can only be done in the animal world, and at that, only very rarely?
Right. So in the human world, you're not going to, you know, go and 3D print limbs. No, that's not, we're not... anywhere close to that. And there's a lot of hoopla and misconception about 3D printing in general. 3D printing is really at its inception, I would say, when it comes to prosthetics. There's a lot of folks online that are doing kind of do-it-yourself, really interesting applications, which is great and really cool. But as far as
What do you mean by interesting applications?
Yeah, so I mean,
You can go online and order a leg.
Well, I wouldn't do that. No,
I wouldn't think so.
That's not a good idea.
Amazon has almost everything.
Right, but don't buy it on Amazon. No. So with 3D printing, there are people who make specific devices. Maybe for someone who's missing a hand, they can make an adapter for something that's needed, maybe to ride a bike or something along those lines.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
But those are specific devices that are fabricated for the outside of the person's limb, not anything attached. So there is that 3D printed technology is really not for internal application for prosthetics.
Who typically knocks on your door, and where's your door at? It's way out there somewhere.
Yeah, so I'm out, and all roads lead to Joliet, Illinois.
Of course, okay.
It's a beautiful place. So who comes? You know, I'm fortunate that I have a pretty active community of patients. I see a lot of athletes, a lot of young people, children, veterans.
Okay, I want to take these. So these are athletes that would see you because... Why?
So I've developed a specialty in treating para athletes, so people who want to participate in athletics that are specific for folks with disabilities and specifically with limb loss.
And you've known some who have made the Paralympics.
Indeed.
And have helped them get there. In fact, without you, they may not have gotten there.
Well, they put in the hard work, and I mean, I'm facilitating that by making the device. But I had the good fortune of being in Rio, where I cheered on six of my athletes. And
six,
yeah.
Wow.
And then just this winter in Korea, I make sleds for the U.S. Paralympic sled hockey team. So
you make the sleds themselves.
Sleds themselves, and they won gold for the third time in a row. So
wow. That is quite incredible, my friend.
Yeah, it's very, very cool to be a part of that. 17 players. So,
all right. Other people that come to you, though, include, you said, veterans.
Yes.
I assume these are people that lost limbs serving our country.
Yes.
Are there special... I know what I want to ask. I don't know how to ask it. I mean, I don't know how affordable it is to buy a limb, and I'm hoping that the government helps these folks.
So prosthetics are very expensive. They're not affordable for most people to buy. I mean, we're relying on insurance. And thankfully...
How expensive? What's a range?
Expensive. I mean, could be... You know, many thousands to tens of thousands of, when you're talking about microprocessor knees, tens of thousands of dollars.
What are microprocessor knees?
So a microprocessor knee is a knee that actually has a little computer in it that tells the knee what to do when the person's walking.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome technology.
So as you've learned more about the human anatomy and doing all this...
Mm-hmm.
Is it pretty amazing that we're all able to get up in the morning and walk out of bed?
I mean, the human machine is a marvel. I mean, our anatomical machine is a marvel, absolutely. And I just wanted to address the question you asked me about veterans. So we've done a really good job with this generation of veterans and taking care of them. I think everyone recognizes that the veterans that came back from Vietnam were not treated properly. And, you know, it's shame on, you know, society, and I think we've made amends for this generation of heroes that have served our country and, you know, sacrificed giving limbs, and so I think we're doing a good job taking care of them.
Mm-hmm. So two questions via text, 312-981-7200. I will ask both of these of you. Ask your guest if he knows Dr. Raymond Pellicore.
Yes. Not personally, but Dr. Pellicore was one of the key...
Is he a pioneer in the field?
Yeah. Dr. Pellicore was involved in taking care of children for many years, a key figure in Chicago in taking care of amputees.
Mm-hmm. He certainly sounds compassionate, meaning you.
I appreciate that.
Where do we find you?
So you can find me by going to info@rotterprosthetics.com. That's R-O-T-T-E-R, the word prosthetics.com. Or you can look me up on Facebook, David Rotter.
You can look everyone up on Facebook, I believe.
That's the way things are done these days.
Yeah. So. It is 1246 on WGN. You have questions, you can call. You can text 312-981-7200. I know I have more questions, and we'll be back next. I just kind of want to let the music play. It's the old DJ in me, David. I can't help that. So the question,
Mac,
the question that we're getting over and over. And by the way, more questions for you than Paul Vallis, who's running for mayor. I don't know what that means.
Okay.
But the question I'm getting over and over, how do you spell the guy's name? So it's R-O-T-T-E-R, correct?
Yes, David R-O-T-T-E-R, David Rotter. Yes.
All right, David Rotter. We have telephone calls, too, 312-981-7200. We can get as many in as we can get in. And good evening. You're on WGN. Hello?
Are you looking for Mary?
I think I am. Hi, Mary.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking the question. I was wondering if you had ever heard of this idea. I heard years and years ago in poorer countries, in order to, you know, accommodate kids with this, you know, with their body changing with the stump and that making it fit into the prosthesis, that they were using beans, like in a bag, so that it would adjust to the shape, you know, as the kids were getting older to make things cheaper. Is that a feasible type of thing, and is it for real?
So I actually am involved with a non-for-profit, and I go down to Guatemala every year. I've done 17 trips, and the most sustainable way to take care of anyone in the developing world is to have local clinics. Specifically, what you're asking about beans or, you know, little pellets, that's really not something that's that's being used these days. The best thing that we can do as specialists that want to help in the developing world is actually go and train local people, provide resources, come in return, and make sure that they have supplies. And that's exactly what we do with the non-for-profit that I work for, or with, I should say. We make sure that there's resources locally, that there's people locally that take care of those individuals, so that people in the region can come over there. It's affordable for them to travel, and they can be taken care of.
All right, Mary?
Oh, it's wonderful to hear. And so I'm just wondering, so do they have to keep remaking the prosthetic, you know, for children as they get older? Is it something that happens?
Yes, yes, it's a great question, and absolutely, that's anywhere that's here in the United States or abroad. And what we try to do is strategically make the prosthesis so that it's a little bit larger, you know, when you're first fitting the child, and we want to try to get as much life out of it as possible. But, you know, just like getting shoes, you know, as the kid's feet get larger and you have to get different shoes and, you know, longer pants with a prosthesis, it's the same thing. So, yes, a child has to be tended towards until they reach skeletal maturity.
All right, Mary, thank you very much. Good questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So when you go to other countries, I want to add on Mary's question. As you go to other countries like Guatemala, are you helping mostly kids in those countries or not necessarily?
Everyone, yeah. So, I mean, it's every age. There's needs at every age. So I wouldn't say mostly kids. I would say probably more mostly adults. One thing that's taken for granted is that we have a fairly safe way of living is for if you're working in a manufacturing environment. Manufacturing environments have precautions that keep you safe. We have roads that, for the most part, keep us safe. A lot of the things that we see when we go down to developing countries are trauma related to motor vehicle accidents or work accidents, electrocutions, just because there isn't the same level of care in tending to things that could be potentially dangerous.
You know, I can't keep up with all the text. Here's one that says, really cool that you help hockey players to see everyone that can play and gets to play hockey with their local team by using these sleds. And this person's involved with a local fundraiser and thanks you for your work.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you.
So if it's as expensive as you say it is, then how in Guatemala or other nations, third world countries, can this stuff be paid for?
Yeah, it's a terrific question. So most of the things that are being fit are donated. And there's just tremendous generosity. You know, there's a lot of bad news that, when we listen to the news, we hear a lot of bad stuff. There's a lot of great people in the world who want to do good for their, for their fellow man or woman, for mankind. And we have patients who donate their old prosthetics, so feet can be reused. I know it seems kind of funny, but prosthetic components can be reused, and that's really the vast majority of the things that we're using when we go down to Guatemala. And then, you know, donations from folks that want to give, where we can actually buy materials and use them down there. We're not fitting microprocessor knees. We're fitting basic devices, but certainly serviceable and getting people up and walking.
These microprocessor knees that you speak of, I know my phone has a glitch every once in a while. My computer does. Everyone's computer does. Did their knees? I mean, is it the same sort of problem with technology at times?
Whenever you have something that is complex and has a lot of moving parts, you're always going to have potential issues. So absolutely, like any other mechanical device, they're susceptible to breaking. And they also have a usable life. I mean, there's only so many cycles that the device can be used, and then it has to be replaced.
Hmm. Now, tell me about Melissa Stockwell or Tammy Duckworth. You know them.
I do know them. So I've had the privilege of...
And others. I mean, we don't have the time to rattle off all these names. I mean...
Yeah. Yes, I've had the privilege of providing prosthetics for both of those remarkable ladies for over 10 years now, for both. And both have made tremendous impacts on the world in their own way. So, I mean, Tammy, it goes without saying, she's a senator of our state. Mm-hmm. Melissa is a celebrated veteran who's brought awareness and has competed in two Olympics.
Yeah,
in athletics, and has basically overcome the adversity of an amputation to show that you can do anything with your life. And you know, it's her saying that she says, "I've done more on one leg than I've done on two in my life," and it just goes to show you that.
Is that your message, by the way, as well?
It really is. A lot of this has to do with your state of mind and your motivation, because that really is going to dictate, you know, how things go, and whether you've had an amputation or not. But especially if you have an amputation or you have a physical challenge. It's what you want to do with it, what you want to do with your life, that dictates kind of where you
can go. Are there people that succeed or fail dependent on their state of mind?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, succeed and fail might be a little bit black and white. Maybe succeed more, mm-hmm. If there's motivation over there.
Okay. Once again, how do people find you?
Okay. So info@... R-O-T-T-E-R, and then the word prosthetics.
However that's spelled.
Right.
Good luck with that.
P-R-O-S-T-E-H-T-I-C-S, info@Rotter Prosthetics, or you can find me on Facebook, David Rotter.
All right, man. Congratulations. That's what all these people are saying.
All right, thank you.
You're making lives better for a whole lot of people. That's not a bad thing.
It's a privilege. I appreciate it.
Thank you.